Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
I don't think you'd even be talking about illegal immigration if it weren't for me. So, we have a country of laws. They're going to go out, and they'll come back if they deserve to come back. If they've had a bad record, if they've been arrested, if they've been in jail, they're never coming back. We're going to have a country again. Right now, we don't have a country, we don't have a border, and we're going to do something about it. And it can be done with proper management, and it can be done with heart.
Donald Trump at the Republican debate last night. The GOP presidential candidates gathered at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in Simi Valley. One of the hot topics was immigration. You just heard Trump. But over the 3+ hours, they touched on a lot of issues. And here to talk about how they did and how the party can move forward are Daniel Garza, executive director of the Libre Initiative, a Latino political outreach group partly funded by the Koch brothers. Welcome back, Daniel.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
Nice to have you. And Ruben Navarrete, nationally syndicated columnist and commentator for CNN.com. Welcome back to you, Ruben.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
Well, Daniel, let's start with you. Your organization is considered conservative, but you've criticized the candidates' hardline stances on immigration. I just want to play you Chris Christie last night trying to, I think, out-Trump Trump.
What we need to do is to secure our border, and we need to do it with more than just a wall. We need to use electronics, we need to use drones, we need to use FBI, DA, and ATF, and yes, we need to take the fingerprint of every person who comes into this country on a visa, and when they overstay their visa, we need to tap them on the shoulder and say, you have overstayed your welcome, you are taking advantage of the American people, it's time for you to go. If we had that kind of system in place, we wouldn't have the 11 million people we have now.
All right. So what did you think about what you just heard from Christie and from Trump and from the others last night?
Well, that portion was reasonable. It's about, you know, visa overstays. But, you know, I think Latinos in this debate, I think, you know, candidates are provided with a golden opportunity to distinguish themselves as a president who will be inclusive and aspirational and statesmanlike. And on immigration, I think last night, with the exception of Jeb and Marco, the other candidates seem to be speaking to a small sliver of voters, which are non-Latino primary voters, and missed an opportunity to distance themselves from, I believe, that has been unhelpful narrative and really unrealistic policies that are not going to get us anywhere.
Yeah. Well, what did you hear from Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio that you liked?
Well, it was their defense of their positions, which are much more sensible. They're much more in the middle, where they're talking about, you know, addressing market forces by, you know, creating or advancing a policy that is going to legalize the folks that are already here and incorporate them into our society and bring them out of the shadows. So that's where, you know, the vast majority of Americans stand. And, you know, and they also believe that we must pass sensible immigration reform.
And Ruben Navarrete, is the party listening to them or is it listening to Trump?
I think the party's torn. It listens to Trump a lot. I don't think it's always trying to outdo Trump, but they definitely see that Trump gets applause lines, and he gets serious applause when he goes out and speaks and places like Dallas or Phoenix, and he speaks to 20,000 people at a time, and he gets a one-minute standing ovation when he talks about ending illegal immigration. So I think you'd be foolish not to have to take on that issue somehow. But I think what Latinos look for, and we haven't done a good enough job of communicating this over the years, is we want people to speak honestly, who speak as grown-ups, who don't just go for simplistic solutions, like let's build a wall and call it a day. And I think that if you end up with an honest discussion of the problem, if you start holding employers accountable and don't just pick on these folks like illegal immigrants who have no vote, who have no voice, who have no power, pick on somebody your own size for a change, I think that Latinos would feel better about the debate. I will say, as that one last remark here, is you can talk about, Republicans can talk about the immigration issue in the micro level, which is down in the weeds of it, about, you know, tracking people as if they're FedEx packages, if you're Chris Christie, or building a wall, or you can talk about it the way Marco Rubio did in the macro, where he talked about, you know, speaking in Spanish because he wants to reach voters who might be inclined to vote Republican. Don't be afraid of Spanish. Don't be afraid of culture. We're an immigrant nation, you know, speaking as the son of immigrants, as he was. Those are the macro themes that I think Latinos look for, and they resonate very strongly with the community.
Okay, let's turn to other foreign policy issues. Trump was questioned on his expertise or his knowledge, and he sounded almost dismissive, said he thinks, well, he would just get along better with foreign leaders than the current president does. And then this is what he said when he was asked about an interview he gave to Hugh Hewitt recently, revealing that he doesn't know the names of many important international figures.
I will say this, though. You was giving me name after name, Arab name, and there are few people anywhere that would have known those names. I think he was reading them off a sheet.
Okay, so then Carly Fiorina came in, and she sounded a lot different.
Having met Vladimir Putin, I wouldn't talk to him at all. We've talked way too much to him. What I would do immediately is begin rebuilding the Sixth Fleet. I would begin rebuilding the missile defense program in Poland. I would conduct regular, aggressive military exercises in the Baltic states. I'd probably send a few thousand more troops into Germany. Vladimir Putin would get the message. By the way, the reason it is so critically important that every one of us know General Soleimani's name is because Russia is in Syria right now because the head of the Quds force traveled to Russia and talked Vladimir Putin into aligning themselves with Iran and Syria to prop up Bashar al-Assad.
Yeah, so there she was talking about General Soleimani of Iran and the Quds force. And so what did you make of that exchange? And what did you make of Carly Fiorina's performance overall, Ruben?
She did terrific. I mean, Madeline, this is a second debate now Carly Fiorina has won. Think about this. She was in the undercard the first time around in the Fox News debate, you know, scratched and clawed her way up into the upper main event in this debate, comes out a winner last time, a winner this time. There's various gifts I was not looking for, but they came up and slapped me in the face that she has. She's a great communicator. She can empathize with people, whether she's talking about the loss of a child or her own struggles in overcoming cancer and other things. She really resonates with people. She connected with people. She talked about the Planned Parenthood video. She was almost welling up, talking about it in a very sincere way. Everybody else on that stage was talking about it with their head. She talked with her heart. I was just incredibly impressed, and I think the consensus today among pundits on the right and the left is that Carly was the runaway winner. Last point, it's significant that if there were two other people who did very well, it was Bush and Rubio. All three of those people, Fiorina, Bush, and Rubio, all drew blood from Donald Trump. They all bloodied his nose. And where Marco bloodied his nose was on the issue of foreign policy. He didn't flinch in making the argument that Marco Rubio has really forgotten more about foreign policy than Donald Trump knows.
And Daniel, Carly Fiorina, and Ruben just mentioned she commented on Planned Parenthood. She actually, you know, with analysis this morning on what she said about those Planned Parenthood videos, was not accurate in her characterization of them. And I just want to play a clip of tape from her talking about those videos.
Anyone who has watched this videotape, I dare Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama to watch these tapes, watch a fully formed fetus on the table, its heart beating, its legs kicking, while someone says we have to keep it alive to harvest its brain. This is about the character of our nation. And if we will not stand up and force President Obama to veto this bill, shame on us.
All right, she's talking about the spending bill. And look, this is not accurate. There's no video of a fetus with a beating heart, you know, while someone talks about harvesting its brain. But Daniel, does that matter to the base?
I suppose in the long run it's going to matter because integrity matters. But I think, you know, what she did here, Ruben is right, Madeline, she spoke from the heart. She was passionate. She was nothing short of impressive. And I think, you know, she seemed polished, informed, and assertive. And on this issue in particular, she was very persuasive. It was very powerful. You know, talking about, you know, from her point of view and her pro-life position, that it speaks to our character as a nation. And I think she spoke for a lot of Americans, and so I think a lot of people related to her. And, you know, frankly, I think this debate really exposed that, you know, Trump is not a policy animal, and Carly showed that she is. You know, the world is a more chaotic and a place, and America is under increasing threat. So the person who can have a grasp of the issues, like Marco Rubio showed and Carly showed, you know, I think is going to get the ear of the American electorate.
All right. So let's talk about this idea of a government shutdown. The candidates were asked, would it be worth a government shutdown to defund Planned Parenthood. And Rubin, according to a CNN poll, 7 in 10 Americans say that it's not worth it. And only 22% said stopping Planned Parenthood should be a priority, stopping funding for Planned Parenthood, $500 million. Were the candidates on stage there out of step with what the rest of the country wants? And what is the Republican Party, how does it react and how does it go forward if indeed there is a government shutdown over this issue?
Okay, here's the thing. I speak to you as someone who's pro-choice. And I wrote about the fact that I wrote about a piece for the Daily Beast where I said that I'd watched all 8 of these videos and they've turned my stomach and they've melted my heart. And I am conflicted over the fact that I'm still pro-choice. And I think there's a lot of people out there who feel that way. And it's very unfair, I think, to rely on a poll about how many people think we should shut down the government based on the Planned Parenthood videos when the media consistently has kept the videos off the air. They've showed less than 1% of the videos on the air. And you have to go out of your way to go find these videos. It's a deliberate attempt by the media and by companies like the one I used to work for at CNN and others to keep these videos off the air so that people aren't exposed to them. But when you are exposed to them and you do see them the way I have, they do leave you very conflicted, even if you are pro-choice, as I am, with the fact that we've been fed all these various fairy tales over the years. And one of them points to what you talked about before. Carly Fiorina got a couple things wrong about keeping a baby alive to harvest its brain. And watching the baby, no. But there were, in fact, videos that talked about a beating heart. Someone saying, look at a beating heart, look at the legs move. In fact, it's a baby. It's not just a clump of tissue. And I think it's very...
But these are separate. These aren't the videos that this particular video of the Planned Parenthood people talking. These are separate videos
together.
That were edited into it. I don't want to get in a conversation about the videos
The point is that it's really not accurate, or it doesn't make any sense to say that 70% of Americans don't want to shut down the government because of the videos when we're not showing them the videos.
Okay. But what about this idea of a government shutdown? I mean, this is something that Americans in general are not in favor of.
I think the last time we went through this, Madeline, we found out that while we are scared about the idea of a government shutdown, when the government does shut down, our lives go on and we sort of realize we don't need government nearly as much as we thought. And there are times, other than government workers who live in Maryland or Virginia, and who rely on government for their daily bread, I think there are many Americans who are content with government just getting out of the way. So it's not necessarily a winning issue for Republicans. It's a dumb thing when they do it, but life goes on for many, many Americans around the country. It's typically not a major issue for us.
Okay. And Daniel, let's one more point on Carly Fiorina. I mean, it's been said that the Republicans have a woman problem. There was one woman on stage last night, and by all accounts, she did very well. Many people, as you say she won the debate last night. Does her candidacy now go toward repairing the Republicans' image amongst women voters?
Well, I'm a male, so I wouldn't know, but my sense is that it does. And it is something, I think, to behold when you have a woman in front of that is standing with 10 other men, and she wins. She did a better job of expressing her ideas, of advancing, I think, sensible policy, sound policy. And the way she expressed herself was just so persuasive. I would think that if men are responding to her in I think the way that they have or beginning to, that women would respond much more. Now, look, this is an endorsement, but my wife was going crazy on Facebook, about Carly, and so were a lot of other women, that I have on my social media feed. So I can tell that she struck a chord. That there is a response out there from even Latina women, who are very excited about the prospect of a female candidate that has that kind of grasp on the issues and is so eloquent and so persuasive.
Right. And when she talked about the whole face comment that Donald Trump made in Rolling Stone, she got, huge applause with that. I want to also ask you about the general impression about the Republican Party, because a Pew poll has shown that the favorability ratings for the Republicans are dropping. They've dropped to 32%. Democrats have risen to 48%. And do you think the debate did anything to reverse those numbers? And if not, what do the Republicans need to do to do that? Rubin.
I don't think that the debates did anything to reverse those numbers, frankly, Madeline. I think that it was a food fight for much of the night. Republicans do not come off well. I declared three winners. That meant that they were on a stage of 11. There were eight losers. And I think that they did not, this was not their finest hour. They continue to get wrapped up in petty personal attacks on one another. But I like polling a lot. I like the polling that says that Hillary Clinton's dropped 20 points among white women in the last couple of weeks, that three-fourths of Americans don't think she's trustworthy, and that there are a bunch of people out there who want to see Joe Biden enter the race, including me. So I think if you want to accept the polls across the board, neither party is doing well right now, mm-hmm. according to polls. And there is a great amount of discontent with the choices that are out there. I have heard that Republicans have a women problem, but I've also heard they have a minority problem. And I'm struck by the fact that every single person running for the Democratic nomination is a white person, and not true on the Republican side.
Mm. And Daniel, what do you think?
Well, look, I think, did this debate change anything? Maybe not. But I can tell you that, you know, if I could compare it to something, I think the Republican National Committee was trying to frame this debate or this entire primary as a Formula One race, you know, where people are zipping past each other and racing. But CNN seemed determined to make it a demolition derby. And, you know, the one that... that was being struck over and over again was Donald Trump. And Ruben was right. You know, that people scored a lot of points.
That was my favorite part.
Right? By every major, you know, my sense was that Trump did not do well at all. You know, he seemed disconnected and stale. His policy position seemed very thin and cliched. And he was petty, you know, most notably against Rand Paul and Jeb. And, you know, I think he was also being condescending to women and on the whole issue of birthright citizenship. Yet, he'll probably gain in the polls again. It's inexplicable.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll have to stay tuned for those polls. We are out of time now. I want to thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Daniel Garza, Executive Director of the Libre Initiative. That's a Latino political outreach group. And Ruben Navarrete, nationally syndicated columnist and commentator for CNN.com. And we want to hear from you. What was the highlight of the debate for you? The low light? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can weigh in on our Facebook page at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, how the internet rallied around a Texas teen who brought his handmade clock to school and then was promptly arrested because his teacher thought it was a bomb. Shani Jardin and Tech News next on Press Play.
Browse the KCRW store and shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and merchandise. Shop to support KCRW only at kcrw.com/store.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, it has been quite a week for 14-year-old Ahmed Mohammed. He was arrested and handcuffed at his school in Texas at the beginning of the week, and now he has an invitation to meet President Obama at the White House. This is the kid who made a digital clock his teacher thought was a bomb. Well, we're going to talk about that and other tech stories with Shani Jardin, co-editor of BoingBoing.net and our regular wizardess of tech. Okay, so I think everyone was pretty much with this story. How could this have happened? So for those of us who aren't aware of the details, run through the whole timeline of events.
Yep. Basically, there's a kid named Ahmed Mohammed who, for a school project, created a clock, a working clock. You can buy like Raspberry Pi kits and different kinds of DIY electronic components. We at Boing Boing are huge into this, so that kids can build their own clocks or other kinds of machines that control cool stuff in the house, or just to learn how stuff works. There's no better way to learn how the world works than by making things. Mm-hmm. So this young maker made a clock, brought it into school, and the teacher and the principal and the authorities who were contacted by the school said, "Oop, brown kid, electronics, obviously it's a bomb."
And Muslim.
And Muslim, with the name Ahmed Mohammed, which obviously means he's a terrorist, according to racist people in Irving, Texas. And it's a town, by the way, that has a history of serious Islamophobia and racism. There's, you know, there's all kinds of think pieces fluttering around mm-hmm. on the web. And you know, the mayor has a really bad track record at dealing with brown people, let's be honest. But so this was like the WTF heard around the world. And President Obama responded with, I think it's the coolest line of the entire Obama presidency. "Cool clock, Ahmed. Want to come to the White House?"
And that was on Twitter.
So Obama's POTUS account tweeted this. So the kid is going to the White House. Mark Zuckerberg invited him to Facebook. There were all kinds of people were posting selfies yesterday, all these tech guys. The man who's like the head of FEMA responded with a picture of a clock that he'd made. He says, I love tinkering with things like this. Cool clock, Ahmed. A lot of different people responded in this way. And, you know, our biggest trafficked post yesterday, we saw someone on Twitter post this as a joke, and we reposted it because we agreed that it was a great joke. Vaguely Arab-looking man of Syrian descent seen in garage building what looks like it might be a bomb. It was a photo of Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs in the famous garage.
Whose father was, I believe, Syrian.
Yeah, so Steve Jobs' biological father was Syrian. And it's just, you know, if you're looking at everything through a lens of fear, then everybody becomes a suspect. And, you know, when this kid, Ahmed Mohammed, he had a press conference yesterday. He was asked, you know, are you going to meet with the chief of police? Well, not without my lawyer. He's my hero. I love this kid.
Well, you know, you raise a good point in that he was taken to the police station and questioned for hours, yeah. I understand, without a lawyer present.
The photo of him handcuffed is just the shot heard around the world. Wearing a NASA meatball T-shirt, for God's sakes. What is not to love about this kid? I want to vote for him for president. Oh, my God. But yeah, so he was repeatedly denied access to a lawyer and to his parents, which is a violation of Texas family code. And every cop in America has made it clear that you have to have a lawyer during questioning. And I guess in Texas, you can get away with more of that in some small towns. And it's a reminder for all of us, you know, that all Americans are created equal, but not all places treat all Americans as equal.
Okay, here's something that maybe we might want to be a little scared of, and this is CNN having access to Facebook's data team throughout the election season.
So
what does that mean for you and me?
Yep. Well, Facebook is rebranding itself and restructuring itself as the next generation news platform. Various studies say that, you know, more than half or about half of America gets its political news, gets its news from Facebook. So Facebook is creating partnerships with large news organizations like CNN, like the New York Times, many others, to make Facebook a primary publication platform. It's interesting because that means that these publishers give over control of, you know, let's say Facebook doesn't like articles about cannabis, for instance. They can limit the number of people who see that. So there are interesting issues of censorship, of control, of freedom of the press. But last night we learned that CNN was getting access to special data from Facebook. Facebook was giving CNN data about the conversations that people were having during the 2015 GOP debate last night. And CNN was then able to shape its editorial coverage, reference what people, you know, the trending topics on Facebook, Trump's creepy remark to Carly Fiorina about her face, or the Lindsey Graham, we're all going to drink more joke.
Was it aggregate data like this is what people are talking about, or was it actual posts that people were posting?
Well, I think public posts are certainly available for anybody to see. Mm-hmm. But I think the big idea for Facebook was a lot of people are talking about politics on Facebook. What are they talking about? This will help us get more viewers and have a more successful piece of political theater.
Well, what's the difference between this and just monitoring Twitter in terms of what people are talking about?
It's much more efficient, and there's a bigger audience on Facebook.
Oh, okay. China is
being creepy.
I guess that's the short version. So it's sent a letter to a number of tech companies, American tech companies, asking them to hand over Chinese user data to the government. They have done this before, have they not?
They have. So basically, China is trying to get U.S. tech firms to pledge to make their platforms, apps, services accessible to the Chinese government. China wants our code and the data that American tech companies gather about users in China to be made available to China. There are very different standards about privacy and about what you're allowed to say freely in China. So all of this is coming around this week because the Chinese government has planned a big tech forum in Seattle between the internet czar of China, as he's known, Liu Wei, and Apple, Facebook, IBM, Google, Uber, And President Obama responded to this by saying, you know, basically American tech companies could be hurt by the anti-competitive practices that China is known for. Basically, China is the biggest internet market. Mm-hmm. And who wouldn't want to cash in on that?
But I remember several years ago, Yahoo getting into big trouble for doing this.
Of course. Google as well, Facebook as well. Each of these companies has had battles and it has had their access limited. And it's just a question of basically how low do they want to go? You know, how much?
Well, have any of these companies said, nope, we are not going to do that. We're about privacy and free expression.
Yeah.
And
So the article that everybody's sourcing around this was in the New York Times. And Paul Moser, the author of this article, reached out to the government of China for comment, reached out also to each of the tech companies that were apparently presented with this pledge or will be formally presented with it. And nobody wants to talk about it.
Oh.
Surprising, huh?
Right to privacy.
Chilling effect.
All right. Finally, let's talk about this crazy story. It seems inexplicable. But
cable cutting.
Yeah. Fiber optic cables in California. People are going and their cable lines are being cut. And of course, these carry the internet, TV, all sorts of stuff that we want, phone calls, FBI investigating. Why are people cutting fiber optic lines?
We don't exactly know, but the FBI said, quote, it's something we are taking very seriously. I think there were 16 attacks in California where somebody basically opens up a manhole where there's no security cameras and snips a fiber optic cable, which cuts off communication to all of the people who rely on that and all of the businesses and perhaps, you know, government labs or police or who knows. It's, you know, we all know about people stripping copper,
meth heads, sell it. Right.
Stripping copper to sell it for drug money. This isn't that clear. And the concern is, well, you know, maybe this is like a terrorist sleeper cell trying to figure out how to kill our infrastructure. It might just be like some stone teenagers who see something that they can get away with and do it because that's a really powerful act, right?
Be something more organized, some kind of protest, corporate vandalism kind
could
of
be.
Thing.
Could be. It's an interesting mystery. I'm not sure. Maybe somebody listening knows what the financial upside is. Maybe there's a huge market somewhere for 2 or 3 inches of high capacity fiber optic cable. I don't think there's a big resale value. I think somebody's just being a jerk.
Crazy kids. Shani Jordan, not a crazy kid.
A crazy adult.
Crazy in the good kind, in a good way, if you know what I mean. Co-editor of boingboing.net. Thanks, Shani.
Hey, thank you.
Coming up, we get an inside look at the brand new Broad Museum downtown. It opens this Sunday. Inside, you go on a strange journey to see the art. It's like going through a birth canal.
It is like going through a birth
canal. Not that I remember that. What you see when you get out after a news update with Jennifer Wolf.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage on our mobile app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. You've probably seen the outside of the brand new Broad Museum downtown. You know, the honeycombed futuristic skin that envelops the building. They call it the veil. Well, today you're going inside the museum, into the vault, as it's known, for a sneak peek before the grand opening this weekend. Alex Capriotti, Director of Marketing and Communications at the Broad, showed us around.
So this is the vault?
This is, well, so we just entered the lobby on the first floor on the Grand Avenue side of the building. And this is a great place where you can really get a sense of the veil and the vault. So to our right now, we're looking at the interior of the veil. So you can see kind of the backside of what drivers see when they're driving by. And then our left side is the vault, which is this very organically shaped, kind of curved, almost cave-like gray structure.
The Broad is 3 stories, 120,000 square feet total, with galleries on the first and third floors. The idea is to start on the third floor and work your way down. To get up there, you step on a narrow escalator that punctures the center of the organic vault. And I do mean organic.
It's like going through a birth canal.
It is like going through a birth
canal. Not that I remember that.
And then what happens, and which is probably why you're saying birth canal, is that you enter into this incredible, light-filled, massive, massive space onto the third floor galleries. So what we're kind of emerging onto right now is a 35,000 square foot third floor gallery space. It has 23 foot high ceilings.
And the first thing we see is a Jeff Koons.
Yes, we come up on Jeff Koons' tulips, which if you know Jeff Koons' work, he makes these pieces that look like they are lighter than air and balloon-like and that they should be floating to the ceiling. But I can tell you that I watched this piece be installed and it is definitely much heavier than that. They're made out of stainless steel, but it is incredibly colorful. It's lavender and bright blue and yellow and orange and green, and it's just quite a greeting when you enter the top floor gallery.
Eli and Edith Broad love Jeff Koons. They have the largest private collection of his work in the world. They've been collecting contemporary art for 50 years and now own more than 2,000 pieces by a couple hundred artists. A fraction will be shown at any given time.
The inaugural installation is really set up somewhat chronologically. So when you start on the third floor galleries, you're kind of pulled to the right over here to a gallery of early 60s Andy Warhol pieces. So you can see through this little hallway here the Campbell's soup cans and a really large Elvis and the double Marilyns.
That's to the right of Jeff Koons' tulips, you know, the usual contemporary art museum fare. But to the left, something a bit different. A new piece by a relatively new artist, Julie Maritou.
She's a younger artist, and this was made, it's a piece called Cairo, and it's actually about the Arab Spring.
The painting is enormous. It's a scribbled, ghost-like cityscape with colorful lines chaotically shooting out of the morass. The lines look like flight patterns. It feels fresh. It feels current. And you can find more of these current pieces down on the first floor.
We have an amazing charcoal drawing. It's a really massive piece by Robert Longo, and it's of the Ferguson police riots in 2014. So that's one of the first things that visitors will encounter in that gallery. And then we also have artists like Takashi Murakami, Goshika Mitsuga, who's a London-based artist, John Curran, Mark Bradford, Mark Grosjean, who's an LA-based artist. So the list goes on and on downstairs here.
Including a video installation from an Icelandic artist named Ragnar Kjartansson.
What we are hearing right now is Ragnar Kjartansson's 9-screen video piece, The Visitors. And he's a young Icelandic artist, and he's created this immersive video piece that is just really stunning and my favorite work in the installation. You want to see it?
You walk into the room and you see 9 video screens. On each screen, there's a musician singing and playing instruments. They were shot individually in separate rooms in an old farmhouse in upstate New York, and the musicians wear headphones to hear what the others are playing in the different rooms.
The room is set up such that each massive screen has a speaker above it that's just playing the sound from that one performer. So as we walked around, you saw that when we were near the men on the piano, we could hear the piano better. Near the woman with the cello, we could hear that better. But obviously, it creates this massive, you know, singular chorus when you're in there. And I have to say, I know the song now because I go in there so much, but I love it.
Back in the lobby of the museum, between the vault and the veil, I asked Alex Capriotti about the space in between two other pillars of the museum, and those are the art critic cabal and everyday Angelenos, the people who will come visit the museum. Reviewers in the LA and New York Times criticized the show for playing it too safe, for giving viewers more of what they've been seeing for about 50 years at other contemporary art museums. You know, the Warhols, the Ruchers, the Baldessaris.
So I guess you've read the early reviews.
Yes.
And what do you make of that? I mean, they're not overwhelmingly full of praise.
You know, I think for me, I'm just excited for when the visitors come and see the space on Sunday when we opened the public.
I mean, do you think that there's a difference between what the visitors are going to take away from this and what art critics take away from it?
I do think there is going to be a difference, and there's so many experiences that you can have here, and you don't have to have, I think you can have a spectrum of knowledge about contemporary art, including no knowledge, and come here and have a different experience too. This collection has a lot of, you know, political art in it. It has every type of medium from sculpture to photography and painting. It's a building that's an experience in itself, and I think it does just evoke a lot of emotion, and I'm curious to see how visitors will experience it and what they'll gravitate toward and what become favorites inside the museum too.
The Broad Museum opens to the public on Sunday. It's free to get in. Coming up on the program, we'll have a conversation about how the museum fits into the larger canvas of LA's cultural scene. That's next on Press Play.
Did you know that recycling your used car is a great way to become a KCRW member? You can donate your car, boat, motorcycle, or other vehicle in support of KCRW. It's one of the best ways to recycle. You'll not only benefit yourself with a KCRW membership and a nice tax deduction, but your car will help support all that you hear on KCRW, from music to news to your favorite cultural programs. We'll arrange everything from the pickup to the paperwork. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, we just got a look at some of the art in the new Broad Museum, which you can see beginning this Sunday for free. The Broad is trying to be a different kind of museum. No admissions desk, no security guards in the traditional don't touch sense. They're supposed to be more like guides, helping you understand the art. And the museum also hopes to jumpstart a different experience downtown. Well, we're going to talk about all of this with Frances Anderton, host of KCRW's Design and Architecture. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
And Carolina Miranda, staff writer covering culture at the LA Times. Hi.
Hello.
Well, you were there yesterday. You had a more in-depth look at the art. And what do you think? Do you agree with some of the critics who are saying this is kind of like same old stuff that you'd see maybe across the street at MoCA?
It's pretty safe. In fact, I'd say you'd probably see more adventurous art at MoCA generally. I think the collection is what it is. Eli Broad is a very blue chip collector. He obviously does a lot of his shopping at Gagosian Gallery. There's a lot of big names. You know, there's Cy Twombly, there's Ed Ruscha, there's John Baldessari, there's 9 Jeff Koons pieces by my count, which, you know, probably represents the GDP of a small Caribbean nation. So, you know, this is a lot of trophy collecting. It's quite safe, and I'm okay with that. It's his private museum, and he can kind of show whatever he wants. I think the issue I took with was some of the curation. It felt a little cluttered. There was like a lot jammed in there, and it didn't seem to quite have a cohesive idea that pulled it together. So, for example, you went into the Jeff Koons area, but there was also this giant painting by LA painter Larry Pittman, who is a terrific painter and is very well known, but it's blocked by this Jeff Koons sculpture. So you didn't really get this clear sense when you walked into some of those galleries, like, okay, what is being said here? What's the focus? How does one artist riff off of the next? How does one influence the next? It felt a little jumbled. It felt like, okay, we're just trying to, we have all this stuff. Let's show it.
Yeah. What about the conceit that you start at the top with a more traditional art from the 50s and 60s, as you say, the Twombly, the Warhol, etc., and then going downstairs to see the more contemporary artists? Does that work for you?
It works for me. It's funny because it's like there are a lot of museums that have circulation patterns that will start at the top. And
like the Guggenheim.
The Guggenheim. Although sometimes the Guggenheim, the curators want you to go up the ramp, but I always start at the top and work backwards. I mean, that's how you navigate the Museum of Modern Art in New York. You start at the top and at the permanent collection and you kind of work your way down. I mean, I think the navigation pattern is part of what makes the museum interesting, you know, riding that crazy elevator up to that collection and then coming down. And the smaller galleries downstairs are actually where you do find some of the more interesting works, you know, this historic painting by Mark Bradford that riffs on the Tulsa riot, Scorched Earth. You have this incredible Jenny Saville drawing. It's almost like it's down there in those spaces, which I think are better laid out than the spaces upstairs, that I think you get to marinate in the art.
Francis, let's bring in the architecture and how it relates to the art. And what did you think in terms of how did it work finally? I mean, we've been looking at the exterior of this museum for a long time now. Do you think it now works now that it is full of art?
I did speak to a number of people yesterday who expressed, they all started with their answer would be, you know, I was really surprised to find that actually it's great. A lot of people had gone to that museum with negative preconceptions, partly, I think, stoked by the ongoing conversation about the exterior. And they got in and people generally responded actually to the physical experience created by those architects that sort of transcended the art experience. Can I just put the art aside for a moment? Mm-hmm. People responded to the theatrical experience created by the architects that was really a way of circumventing a problem, which was how do you build a public museum that's essentially a storage container? How do you make a storage container
For the Broads collection
that sits in the middle of the building. It has galleries above it. It has galleries below it. But there's this vast vault wrapped in the so-called veil. So what the architects did was they made an experience out of a problem. They have this escalator, as you discovered, it goes through the birth canal. You mm-hmm. go from a very dark, kind of strange, cavernous experience, and you emerge into the light. And then from there, you can take different routes down. The whole thing is a little bit of an adventure park. In terms of the art itself, I found people who felt the art was very accessible. But Christopher Hawthorne, on the other hand, he felt that the ground floor experience was where it got interesting, both in terms of the art and in terms of the architecture, that the architectural spaces downstairs for the art were more interesting than the top spaces, which, depending on your point of view, had either remarkable light or a somewhat oppressive, unifying, homogenizing kind of light.
I have to say, one of the highlights for me when I saw it yesterday, and I didn't get a chance to look at everything, was this infinity mirrored room. Did you go into that?
The Yayoi Kusama. I did not go into it yesterday, but I have been into those similar works on several occasions, and actually was in the Broads piece when I visited with the LA Times a few weeks ago. And I do love the sense of entering into that little cavern doorway and coming into this space that is really a dead end, but sort of feeling like you're in a space of infinity.
So just to describe it, this is a room that is covered in mirrors and there are lights everywhere, colored LED lights, and you're standing on a platform over some water, which is also mirroring the lights, and the lights kind of go off and on and you're having a full sensory experience. And for me, it kind of mirrored the building itself. What did you think?
Well, if you talk to Liz Diller, she will use words like sensory. The building does provide a sensory experience. And it's kind of fascinating because really one of the challenges that this building has to contend with is its situation on Grand Avenue. Grand Avenue has had this rather tortured 55 years of trying to turn itself into a cultural and civic and commercial center. And the result has been a street of monolithic cultural institutions that are still grasping to have the buzz. And those buildings tend to be rather, let's just say it's not a sensual environment, Grand Avenue, simply put. It is not a sensual environment. Its development has been driven largely by the car and by parking structures. And then along comes this building that is contending with that history. And you walk in and you're in this soft, sensual, cavernous, almost erotic space that's taking you up through the birth canal. Then you've got this muted, soft light. It is highly sensual, and the architects are proud of that achievement. And I think there's something, to be honest, I think it's kind of an odd experience, mm-hmm. actually going off of ground, those hard surfaces where, you know, the ground is so shallow you can barely even put tree roots in, so they've brought in these olive trees to add some greenery, that the street is so arid, in part, as I say, due to the sort of development that made it so. And then here we are in this cave, and then we're thrown into this heavenly light experience.
It is quite jarring at first. But I think also what was promoted at the beginning was that this was going to open up the street, that there was going to be a dialogue between the museum itself and the street to create a street life. And do you think that it does that, or is it more hermetically sealed?
I think that remains to be seen. I think that was I profiled Liz Diller for the paper, and that was her big challenge as an architect, you know, was Eli's contradictory goals, which is I want to urbanize Grand Avenue and I'm going to do it with my art storage unit. You know, like, it just doesn't make any sense. You know, the architects were able to flip the equation. So now there's less storage unit and more art exhibition spaces. And, you know, the architect did make some efforts. They did make some efforts to try to dialogue with the street, sort of cutting those entrances open on sort of the northern and southern ends, of creating this arcade that you can walk through even if you don't enter the museum, of trying to do, I think, everything possible to like bring people through there, even if they don't go to the third floor, but at least create an interesting pedestrian experience. Because as Francis notes, yeah, I mean, a lot of Grand Avenue looks like it was designed by bankers. You know, this is not a compelling stretch of Los Angeles to walk.
I think the three of us would agree that Eli Broad is not a kind of a natural promoter of like the pop-up public experience. You know, that's not who Eli Broad is. You know, I think, I don't know, I think it slightly goes against his nature, you know, to sort of be thinking about how to get Grand into this super
party,
lively, spontaneous
yeah.
place. But he's very proud of the Grand Park. He feels that he was part of making that park happen.
Well, so what are the financials for Eli Broad in this? He is saying that this is a gift to the city in a way, that this is his, you know, his private collection that he's making available to the public for free. What does he get out of this besides goodwill?
Well, it's all run through a foundation. So he's been basically buying a lot of art tax-free and cementing a certain legacy. I mean, you know, they keep describing it as this gift to the city, the gift to the city. It's a private museum. And that's fine. You know, Miami has a lot of private museums. The frickin' New York started as a private museum. That's okay. If he had really wanted to make a gift to LA, he would have donated his collection to LACMA and maybe some of the other institutions around here so that they could truly be in public hands. It's this very sort of Eli Broad gesture of like, I'm going to show my collection, but I'm still going to hold on to it at the same time. And I feel like the architecture of that building so says that story. It's like, I'm going to keep it in this vault, but you can come through and look at it. You know? So there's sort of this thing of like, I want to give it. I don't want to give it. So it's kind of this strange entity in that sense. But I think as a private museum and as a place that's free and as a place where people can go and see art for free, and because it's free, they'll be able to just kind of pop in and maybe just hang out for a little bit and not have to make a whole day of it. You know, that's great. That's good. That's good for LA.
Yeah. And this has been getting national, if not international, attention.
Oh, yeah. Lots of journalists were flown in by the Broad.
Yeah.
As well as others that paid their own way. But yeah, no, it's a great big party this
week.
Okay,
well, journalistic ethics aside.
We were not flown in.
You paid for your gas and your parking.
Yeah, we got some coffee.
But, I mean, do you think that this elevates Los Angeles nationally, internationally, this museum?
I think it's made us the topic of discussion for a few weeks. You know, is it part of a whole sequence of things that is happening in LA that is currently making LA sort of this discussion, this art world discussion? Yes, it's sort of one of the data points. Sort of the Zumthor plan for LACMA is another one. MoCA's new leadership is something else. You know, this array of new galleries that we're seeing open up, you know, coming soon with like Hauser Wirth and Schimmel in downtown Los Angeles, which is going to be 100,000 square foot of art insanity. You know, so I feel the museum is a data point in a lot of data points for what is making LA an interesting arts destination. It's not the data point.
I also think it's interesting to have a work by Dilla Scofidio and Renfro, the architects. You know, when they won the competition to design the Broad, they were probably the least well-known of the firms that were competing for that project. And so to the extent Mr. Broad took a sort of a risk on an architectural firm, one could say this was a little bit of a risk. They have become now extremely highly regarded for their work on the High Line. They were designers of the High Line, and also for their intervention in the Lincoln Center. The Lincoln Center was, in the mid-last century, it was the precursor, it was the model for Grand Avenue. I find it very interesting that they now have become engaged with Grand Avenue, which is tussling with exactly the same challenge that the Lincoln Center was tussling with, that urban renewal that took place in the 50s, the city, the idea of the city beautification, these creating these clusters of civic landmarks and whether that worked or not, and now trying to sort of rehabilitate them in a way that are far more engaged with the street, engaging to the public. And Dilla Scofidio and Renfrew have been sort of have intervened on two very significant examples of those. And I'm really interested to see how the public does respond to it.
Okay, well, they will respond one way or another beginning on Sunday.
They sure will. I mean, they're sold out, so.
People are very curious.
And I think the building combined, the art is very accessible and the building is theatrical. Like, it will draw people. It will draw people. And I think, you know, on a civic level, say what we might about the art or the building, the fact is it's not some boring condo tower with some boring stores at ground level. It's going to be interesting.
Yeah, one person I spoke to said, in his view, it's already an icon. The building's already got people giving it kind of characteristics. One group calls it the mattress. Another critic said it had a texture like a filter fish. Oliver Wainwright of The Guardian said it looked like it was like a cheese grater, something that would grate the Disney Concert Hall. So the building is prompting nicknames.
Yeah. Well, this is L.A. I think it looks like Menudo.
Well, thank you both. Carolina Miranda, staff writer at the LA Times. Frances Anderton, host of KCRW's DNA, Design and Architecture. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
We welcome Julie Myers with the listener feedback. Hi.
And the Broad welcomed us yesterday.
Yep.
Pretty cool stuff. We asked our listeners about their favorite LA museums. Eric Torres is a huge fan of LACMA. He says on Facebook, the collection is unparalleled. But John Spoden says Museum of Jurassic Technology takes number one in his heart. So many good museums here in Los Angeles.
Right. And so the more the merrier is what I say.
That's
Julie
right.
Myers, thank you very much. Warren Olney and To the Point up next at 1 o'clock. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a fantastic afternoon. I'll see you tomorrow.